Hello, this is Tanis from Inner Circle Sanctuary, our Mother Coven here in Las Vegas, Nevada. And it is my good fortune today to be talking with Aaron Lael, community leader, heathen, Asatru, Gidja, priestess, and author who's got a new book coming out on Wiser Publications. So good morning, Aaron. How are you in this age of COVID-19?
Thank you. Good morning. I'm doing okay, but I'm being as careful as I can be.
That's good to hear. We are too. And just as you and I are talking today online, all of our functions have gone online for the time being until scientists and doctors give us the all clear.
Yep.
So how has, for you, have your practices changed due to COVID-19?
Well, I pretty much had to cancel all of our, it just wasn't practical to even try to do any of them until Nevada entered phase two. And then by that time, everybody was used to not doing things in person. And after you've been doing things alone for a few months, then suddenly you sort of go, well, the government says I can do it, but that doesn't mean it's safe.
Right.
Do I want to do this thing that I don't absolutely have to do to survive?
Right.
So we kind of haven't done anything. We are planning to resume some activities, but only ones that we can do outdoors and with a limited number of people.
Sure. And then of course, like we're talking in July, and this weekend is well in the triple digits. Do you do group gatherings, rituals and festivals during the day, or do you at least wait till night for it to cool down some?
We have done things during the day quite a bit, but the thing we're planning to do this summer is going to be at sunset and shortly after sunset so that we can be outside and we're actually going to be in the pool most of the time. That's going to be our plan, is to wait till the sun goes down and go outside and get in the pool. Even when the sun is like down, it's still, last night, right around the time we were planning to do our thing next, when we do it, around like 8:30 at night, about a half an hour after sunset.
Yeah.
It was still 104 degrees outside.
Right.
Yeah, so even after the sun goes down, it's still really hot. So I'm planning to do what I call the mermaid ritual, which is, it's going to be blessing in the name of the mothers of Heimdall, which we understand to be basically mermaids. They're the nine waves of the sea, the daughters of Aegir.
Very cool. That sounds like a fantastic way to celebrate Heimdall and his nine mothers in a pool. Practical,
yeah.
Fun, and cool.
Yeah.
So, speaking of your practices, you've been in Las Vegas in the desert for quite some time and practicing heathenry, Asatru. We tend to think of course, it's a Northern European sourced religion, and it is, except up in Mount Charleston, it is nothing like Northern Europe in the desert out here. So has that in any way affected how you honor the gods or practice your religion?
Well, it does, especially with the calendar, because there are certain rituals that were meant to be like planting and harvest and so forth, and they just don't work on the Northern European calendar here. I actually grow wheat myself that I use to make the Northern Lights Goddess's Brew, And I plant it in December and harvest it in June every year. So that's my planting and harvest calendar is like flipped the total opposite way.
Wow. I'm from Pennsylvania originally, so even in December out here, to me it feels like fall or spring.
Mm-hmm.
And I tend to tell people we pretty much have the two seasons here, hot and not quite as hot.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk a bit about yourself. So how long have you been in Las Vegas?
Since 95.
And where did you grow up?
I'm originally from Northern California, Sonoma, the land of the green sheep. See, the sheep roll in the grass. Oh. They get grass seed in their wool, and then it rains, and it sprouts.
Oh, my gosh.
That's how you get green sheep.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I've never heard of that. That's so funny. And what brought you here?
Well, I wanted to move to the desert. I was actually born in Ripon, California, not in Sonoma, which is in the Central Valley of California, and it's a desert. And although I liked Sonoma as far as, you know, the people and the culture and everything, I was really tired of rain by the time I was done with college, and I was thinking about where I wanted to move to, you know, live my life, because it wasn't going to be Sonoma. Nobody stayed there after that in order to work unless they, you know, had a family in with one of the wine growing companies or something like that, or they had some sort of profession like teachers and doctors.
Uh-huh.
My parents were teachers, that's why they were there. But if I wasn't going to do those specific types of jobs, I had to move someplace else. So when I was deciding where I wanted to be, I thought, you know what? I like the desert, even though I didn't like Ripon because it was full of bigots.
Uh-huh.
And that's something that it was so completely full of bigots that I noticed that even though I moved out of there when I was 9. So, you know, that's a lot of people think that kind of stuff passes right over the heads of little children. Well, it didn't.
Wow. Is that like a farming community? Rednecky
It was a farm town. Sonoma is also a farm town, just with different kinds of attitudes.
Okay.
Those were both farming communities, but one of them was completely different than the other.
Mm-hmm.
Even, you know, two California farm communities, totally opposite from each other.
Gotcha. Well, when did you discover Ossetru, how did you discover it?
Well, if I go back all the way to the beginning, it probably started with Tolkien when I was a little kid. As I got used to thinking about elves and runes and so forth, and that was introduced to me early on. And then, so I was primed and ready to accept these ideas when, on my 17th birthday, my brother's girlfriend, who was a Wiccan, gave me the book, Futhark Handbook of Rune Magic.
Right.
And when I read it, I felt like I was not learning new things, but remembering things I already knew.
Nice.
And I knew that was my path.
Mm-hmm.
Just that, as soon as I started reading it, I knew that was my path.
And it seems to me that runes are often the way that people then discover the gods and Northern European mm-hmm. paths. I know, you know, I grew up loving the mythology as it was put to us, mm-hmm. but didn't know that people still practiced worship of the gods. And then when I discovered runes, that mm-hmm. led right into then finding more books like Edgar Thorson's and Freya Ashwin's, and led more to studying and practicing some heathenry. Do you think
mm-hmm.
that Do you think that might be the main way? I would also think that Wicca is often kind of a gateway to heathenry in that regard.
Well, that was certainly the main way into heathenry for my generation, because we were the generation that found those books in our bookstores.
Right.
And before that, there was probably more people got into it via other people, because there just wasn't as much available in bookstores and libraries and popular culture. Although starting from way back, people of course got into it from literature, and a lot of people. A lot of people these days get into it from the Marvel movies, but that's been happening since there weren't movies, and people were getting into it by reading the Marvel comics.
Right.
Way, way back before the movies were even made. So there's all kinds of ways to get into it. And some people find it because they start researching Norwegian ancestors or something. There's like...
Yeah, I saw a brief TED talk with a young lady who was a heathen and was very, let's say, not happy with the way that the gods are portrayed in the Thor movies and Avengers and stuff like that, with a lot of the costuming and things like this, which I get. I totally understand her opinion. But I think myself being older and seeing it absolutely as a way that might perk up people, especially young people's interest in alternate religions, that overall it's a very good thing.
Yeah, that's kind of my opinion too, is that yes, it's not accurate. And there was actually a time when I was done watching one of the Marvel movies, and when I left the theater, I was thinking, I bet I could make a much more authentic story than that. And I ended up writing a humongous, gigantic novel that like turned into trilogy size, and it's completely unpublishable. Only one person I've showed it to ever finished reading it.
Wow.
Yeah, but that was my path to connect with Odin and Loki in a way that I had never done before. And that's actually how I ended up adding Godspouse to my list of titles, because they came to me as muses to inspire me to write. And I learned so much.
Well, that's awesome. But when you say it's unpublishable, what about like self-publishing or Create Space or something like that?
Well, I've showed it to several people, many people in the heathen community or other pagans, especially Lokians. And like I said, only one person I've showed it to ever finished reading it. People have reported having serious magical experiences while they were reading it. One person said that she'd been reading a scene about Thor, and the Thor candle on her altar lit itself.
Wow.
And but that same person didn't finish it either.
Uh-huh.
She later ran into a scene that she found highly offensive and stopped reading.
Oh.
And that happens. Like, this novel is about Ragnarok.
Okay.
It's about the end of the world, and one of the things in the story is that I'm showing how messed up the world is by that point, and why it needed to be just completely destroyed so it could be started over again.
Okay.
The idea is the world gets so completely, totally messed up that all of the gods agree it's time to push the reset button on the universe and just destroy everything, start completely over.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of things in the story that are meant to show why the world is ready to be destroyed at that point and can't be saved any farther than that. And many of those are the most magically powerful scenes, the ones that carry people to visions and crack open their brains to hear or see things about the gods and the universe. But they're also emotionally devastating. They were emotionally devastating to write.
Uh-huh.
Now, to me, the entire journey of writing that was a healing journey for me.
Okay.
I had some unhealed childhood trauma that I had gotten therapy for in my 20s, and I'd gotten like 95% of the way, and I had just resigned myself to the idea that I was never going to get 100%.
Mm-hmm.
That last 5% was just going to elude me forever, and it turned out not to be true, but it took me a year of dedicated effort to go with this writing project in which I retold the entire corpus of heathen lore and added interstitial material between each of the stories in the lore that connected it all together. And it was all written from the perspective of Loki telling the story to a human character who stood for me. And it was her journey, starting with her death and ending with the end of the universe.
Yeah.
So it was an underworld journey, like that one that Virgil did in the old world, like that. And it started as an underworld journey and went through all of the worlds, ascending higher and higher until we finally got to Asgard. And it was a healing journey for her and for me.
Yeah.
And I'd like to think it would be a healing journey for other people who had the same issues too, but it's just too much for most people. So it's really not something that could be published as just an entertaining novel. I've come to that conclusion.
Understood. And regardless, I hope you publish it somehow, some way, whether it's with a publisher or, you know, self-published. That sounds amazing. You know, if people are willing.
Well, instead of actually publishing the actual novel itself, what I've done is I've extracted some of the personal gnosis that I realized when I was writing it, and I've extracted that into some essays and lists about my gnosis that I'm planning to publish in a nonfiction book. Wow. Of essays with some other writers who also have experienced religious gnosis while they were writing fiction.
Okay.
And I actually have that ready to go, and that's looking for a publisher right now. I actually had a contract for that book once, and then the company that I had contracted it with went out of business. And I did show it to my current publisher, but they are not interested in anthologies. So,
well, that sounds really interesting too. I'll look forward to that.
Yeah, I think it's going to be great. It's got some really great other authors involved. Mostly other heathens and pagans. Because that's how my social network works.
Right. So when I was looking at your biography and your website, of course you've done a lot of writing through your lifetime, and editing and blogging. You made a film that I saw on YouTube. You have recorded some of the topics in your book, like the symbol and the bloat. And then mm-hmm. some of the things that I thought were really interesting is that you owned the science fiction store here in Las Vegas. And whatever happened?
Yes. Well, I got sick and couldn't work. That's what happened. It was. I opened that right when I first moved to town in 95, and it took me a while to kind of get it going. And I happened on a really great business model, which was to get a celebrity in to sign books.
Yeah.
And also the other half of the great business model was that it turned into mostly a role-playing game store rather than a novel oriented one. And I would, I'd sold game books, and I sold a lot of things like t-shirts and a lot of game related merchandise. Like at the time, the big thing was Vampire the Masquerade. And I sold these customizable vampire teeth that you could set so that you could make your own little vampire teeth.
Very cool.
And stuff like that. That was great, but I got sick.
I don't know how.
And then I lost everything
there.
What's that?
I said, I don't know how I did not end up inside your shop. That sounds like it would have been right up my alley.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I had advertisements running on cable TV the whole time. So, you know, and I did conventions, and, if you went to a book signing with Buzz Aldrin at Planet Hollywood, that was me.
Oh, wow. That's pretty amazing. I'm sorry it closed down and you got sick and had to shut it down and you're now though?
Yeah, now that's one of the challenges I've had in my life is that I have PCOS, polycystic ovary syndrome. Mm. And pretty much the entire time from when I was like 9 until last year, I always had to wonder if I was going to start uncontrollably bleeding again and need a blood transfusion and get sick and be unable to do stuff.
Oh my God.
I had my first blood transfusion when I was 12. I spent like an entire summer bedridden.
Oh no.
Like literally couldn't get out of bed. My brother had to carry me around. I read a lot of books though.
Yeah.
This is one of those things, you know, one of the things that set me on my life path in writing and editing is that books were such a huge part of my life because I couldn't do anything else.
Yeah. Well,
but now I'm in the Crohn stage of life, so now I don't have to worry about it anymore.
Well, that's good. And I'm glad to hear that you're healthy and staying healthy. And I assume wearing a mask if you go out and otherwise stay in quarantine?
Yeah, pretty much. Although I've discovered that I can't really tolerate wearing a mask outside in the afternoon in this heat. Okay. It's just too hot.
Right.
I just stay home.
Yeah.
That's and you know, people are saying, well, you don't have to wear it outside, but yeah, you do if there are like other people there, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just respect. It's just showing respect to your fellow man. The other thing that I really thought was cool is that you've done Chinese martial arts. And I'm a huge practitioner and evangelizer for myself, Tai Chi. But, you know, like my son was a young Kung Fu student. And, you know, I've done some Kung Fu. And I always like to talk to people about the martial arts that they practice, and especially in the world of Chinese martial arts, there are so many, and there is not this there is not this kind of taboo of doing other Chinese martial arts. And most practitioners that you talk to practice several kinds, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So can you tell me a little bit about what you did or do?
Well, I actually grew up in a kung fu school. My brother's home business that he operated out of the family home was Lael's Kung Fu Academy. And the style that he taught was called Shaolin Shoshu Way of the Beast. The Way of the Beast part was like his little twist on it. Uh-huh. And it was kind of a proto MMA actually, because he'd studied kung fu, and he'd studied karate, and he studied western fencing, and he studied uh-huh. street fighting, and he studied a whole bunch of different things and kind of put them together.
Interesting.
So I actually grew up like literally living in the kung fu school.
Uh-huh.
And when my brother would get an idea about a new technique in the middle of the night, he'd come knock on my door and say, "Wake up, I want to try such and such." So, yeah, my teenage years, I spent fully expecting that at any time in the middle of the night, I could be woken up to fight a grown man in pitch darkness with my glasses off. And so, yeah, I kind of learned how to do that.
That's awesome. Kind of like use the force, Luke, practicing blindfolded and in the dark.
Mm-hmm.
Very cool.
And then later on, I studied a little Wing Chun, but mm-hmm. Only because one of my brother's other students was a teacher of that style, and mm-hmm. I had been looking for a new style to compete with.
Yeah.
And then in my 20s, I studied Berserker Ganger, which is a style that's directly derived from the heathen fighting styles.
And where did you learn that, and how was it transmitted? Was that taken from like medieval manuscripts, the diagrams in there? Because I've seen a lot of Renaissance style sword fighting and grappling and things.
Mm-hmm.
As far as what you practiced, was it all, you know, also like a reconstructionist type of thing? Was it partly partly spiritual, getting into the whole astral wearing of a skin type of thing?
It was very much a spiritual tradition. In fact, that was the main thing.
Okay.
It was actually taught as an initiatory tradition. And they said that it was an unbroken style from the ancient days. I don't really think that was true. I think it was largely reconstructionist. Just based on internal evidence, because they didn't teach any actual fighting techniques. It was all internal. It was 100% a do rather than a te in Eastern terms.
Okay.
And I would think that if it had actually been transmitted unbroken from ancient times, that there would have been both weapon and wrestling styles and small unit tactics that would have been preserved.
Right.
And there wasn't. So we basically just studied the internal forms, and everyone was expected to already have their own fighting style that they would apply that to, which I did. I already had kung fu, so.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the best aspects of learning martial arts as a child, is your own awareness of your body, how to move mm-hmm. it, when to move it, knowing right from left, you know,
mm-hmm.
and that taking that adaptability to different martial arts or different physical forms of exercise or art. But you also bring up an interesting point, the whole thing about unbroken lineages and ancient origins and as a person who discovered Wicca and paganism in 1989, that of course was still rampant, and pre-internet, you only had the books that were available to you at whatever bookstore you were at. So if you picked up a witchcraft book that said, you know, this is an ancient technique, it was you know, hard to fact check that or whatever. We were talking about this the other day, about the need for that. And I think that was one of, and Wicca, Gerald Gardner's only mistakes, trying to claim that Wicca was, you know, some kind of old unbroken lineage when clearly it was not. Do you find that same do you find that same type of thing still rampant in Asatru or other heathen circles?
Not as much now.
Okay.
Since the age of the internet started, we've had access to documents that have been in university collections and museum collections in Europe that we were completely unable to access before the internet, and we've had access to European people who interpret it for us and speak their own language, and we've had just an explosion of academic study.
Yeah. So one of the things that we brought up is, would people have been attracted to religions that are reconstructionist, or new interpretations? I mean, we can't exactly do the same thing the ancients used to do. Would people be attracted to that? And why, you know, if that is one of the only things that brings people to these alternative religions, why, what is that impulse that, you know, somebody might discover Wicca, think it's old, think it's great, and then when they discover, you know, a bunch of it is from Crowley, a bunch of it is from the Key of Solomon, a bunch of it is just not ancient, and then it doesn't seem as magical. Why is that? It still works. It's still, what is that? What do you think is that impact?
Yeah, well, that's disillusionment. And some people can have their spirituality survive disillusionment and find new growth in a new way. And some people are so disappointed they look for something else. Mm-hmm. And that's okay, because, you know, this path isn't necessarily for everyone. And even if it is right for someone for, you know, 10 years of their life, some other path might be right for them later.
Right. Right. I guess I didn't see that quite as much with the runic and Asatru books that I read. But every once in a while it would pop up. And even with runes and stuff, to me it seemed kind of obvious if the meanings of the rune were really abstract, kind of psychobabbly meanings. And I would get to thinking, really, the runesters serving, you know, a war leader or something, asking about life and death issues, would come back to that leader of a battle and say, well, your motivation is for success, but you feel held back by childhood, conditioning or stuff. It just didn't seem. It didn't seem ancient, even though that is one of the things that I see nowadays. Like if I'm reading Amazon, if I make the mistake of reading reviews on Amazon, there's still that's not real Asatru, that's not real runes, this is, you know, that kind of garbage.
Yeah. Well, the rune reading is an intuitive practice. So it has more to do with the person reading and the person being read for than the actual runes. By the time you get to an advanced level, you're barely even looking at them or thinking about their official definitions.
Sure.
Just like I'm sure it's the same with reading tarot or any other divination system. The official definitions are training wheels. That's how you start, but that doesn't mean you're supposed to stay like that forever.
Right. And what I'm assuming that you are a reader of runes. Which set do you prefer?
Yes.
Younger, Elder, Anglo-Saxon, Northumbrian, Elfdalian? Which set do you like best?
Well, I like the Elder Futhark best because that's what I started with, and I made a connection with it when I was 17, and I've looked at other runic alphabets since then, but I just never felt that same connection with any of the others. Part of that, of course, is if you learn something when you're a teenager, you have it for life.
Right.
That's the same thing as with dance or martial arts or anything else. If you learn it when you're a child, you know it.
Yeah. So a couple more runic questions. Do you think when Tacitus wrote his bit about the Germanic tribes that he visited, and he talked about somebody using cuttings of trees, saying an invocation and throwing them on a cloth, do you think he was talking about runes?
Well, whether he was or not, that's the basis for how we do rune casting. So even if it was actually something else, this is the way we do it now. So
sure.
Just like any other question in the lore, if the lore is unclear, but we have like three generations of people doing X thing now, there's really only a few circumstances in which we need to change it just because it's not, said that way in the lore.
Okay.
One of those circumstances was if things were actively borrowed from another tradition just to fill in the gaps. And there were a lot of things like that in early Ossetru. Ossetruers of my generation started out using Thorsen's Hammer Rite, which is
Absolutely.
Very clearly calling the quarters.
Absolutely.
And that's not something that was done in ancient times. There are still Ossetru groups that do that. And there are also Ossetru groups that have stopped doing that because they feel that it's not authentic and they replace that with something else.
I found it very effective for doing what it does.
Mm-hmm.
So it sounds to me like you have a good eye to the past, but are definitely, you will adapt for modern times and have a very realistic point of view when it comes to that. Like you're mm-hmm. not strictly bound by what you can read as far as the bits of information that we do have about things, how they were practiced in the past.
Yeah, that's true. We're never going to have the complete picture. There's always going to be more to learn. We keep making new discoveries all the time, even not only new discoveries in archaeology, but even new discoveries in literature. It's been only a few years since Lhotka Tatar was discovered by the wider heathen community. I want to put discovered in like air quotes because obviously the people of the Faroe Islands had that tradition the whole time.
Uh-huh.
But the wider heathen community didn't get this piece of literature until very recently, and it has really added a lot to our understanding of Loki and of the trinity of Odin, Hoenir, and Loki. And it's something that is part of the process of building up an understanding of our gods. and it contributed a lot to that. But we were already on the road towards a greater understanding of those gods based on people's personal experiences.
Mm-hmm.
before we even discovered this new literature.
Very interesting. I like the fact that new research, new air quotes discoveries, also informs your practice, and hopefully
mm-hmm.
the also true heathenry world at large. And let's talk about that a little more.
Mm-hmm.
So this is, especially with new developments and new discoveries and probably more experience, this is one of the reasons why you're putting out a new edition of your book.
Yes. Yeah, and of course, another reason is because there has been some new developments within Ossetru since I originally wrote my book. And one of those is the rise of the modernist movement. And what that is a movement in which people are rejecting what we called the folk way in my generation. That was people trying to adopt some of the historical ways, like not cutting beards and things like that. And so now we have traditionalists and modernists.
Uh-huh.
And we didn't have that before.
So it's an interesting thing that you bring up about the hair, because I found that one of the more fascinating parts of your book, because you talk about not cutting the hair, and
mm-hmm.
And also relate that. So not cutting the hair, what is the importance of that?
The important thing about not cutting the hair is that in the ancient world, cutting the hair and the beard short was the mark of a slave. That was how you told the difference between a free person and a slave in the ancient world. And free people possess personal honor. And in the ancient world, they did not consider slaves to possess personal honor. They only participated in the household honor of the households in which they lived, like children do. So in order to have personal honor, you had to keep your hair and beard the way nature grew it. Now, there was an exception for that.
Okay.
And the exception was if you were a soldier. Anyone in the farming and warrior class was considered a warrior if you were a free person, but a soldier was something completely different. That was a mercenary who served another country,
uh-huh.
Rome, or later Norse or Germanic countries in the Christian age, but originally the Roman Empire and the Byzantine Empire. And in the Roman and Byzantine empires, the soldiers shaved their faces.
Uh-huh.
So when they went down there and joined the Roman or Byzantine military forces, they would shave their faces too. And so there was always an exception for that within the ancient heathen traditions, because the soldiers maintained warriors' honor despite cutting their hair and beards.
To me, that just, it seems so counterintuitive, however, with especially the issues of lice and bed bugs, not to mention having long hair and a long beard is a great way to get your head grabbed when you're in battle or when you're being ambushed or assaulted. And then as a modern person, like, I got from my Germanic grandfather a baldness pattern, and there is no way I'm going to run around with a ring of hair around my head and bald to the top like the dragon or the dungeon master in the old Dungeons and Dragons cartoons. So in that regard, if I was a heathen, would I be considered a modernist? Because I am shaving my head and shaving my face to boot.
That's one of the things that modernists do, is just go, you know what, this old tradition doesn't apply to me, so I'm not going to do it. That's one of the things modernists do. Now, there are a lot of people that started out as traditionalists and have adopted some of the ways of modernists, but not all of them. So they're kind of an in-between kind of group that I call the modernized traditionalists. And I'm kind of one of the modernized traditionalists myself, because I've adopted some modernist ways, but I still do the don't cut the hair thing. That's I've been doing that since I was a teenager, and I'm not going to stop now.
Does it just naturally break off?
Yep.
Interesting. And you also relate the cutting the hair for a drug test as an infraction or an imposition on a free person's freedom. Again, with the exception for military, which I was, but we did urinalysis tests. Now, is a heathen allowed to do a urinalysis test? It's not involved with the hair, but it would involve somebody's honor. If I'm telling you I haven't done drugs, why are you making me take a urinalysis test?
Yeah, heathens can do the urine and blood tests. It's not actually about a challenge to your word. It's about a cultural norm in which long hair and beards was the mark of a person who possessed personal honor. In other words, someone who was a free person.
Mm-hmm. But I saw recently that, I can't remember what branch he was in, but I think it was probably the army, but a heathen won an exception to keep his beard.
Yes.
And I don't know that he's special forces, and they've been doing that for a long time to fit in with the locals where they're theater that they're in. And then my only concern is chemical attacks and gas warfare. That was a major part of our training and exercises when I was in, of course, those were 30 years ago. But you don't get a good seal on your gas mask if you have facial hair beyond, basically a night. You know, they told us not to shave the night before so that the tear gas wouldn't sting our face and pores so badly. But if you grow out even a little bit of stubble, your gas mask does not seal. So he's kind of shit out of luck.
Yeah, I actually read about that. That was a kind of a big deal in the online heathen world. We wanted to know all about that, and that was a huge debate. Because in my forum, we've got both modernists and traditionalists. So there was a huge debate about beards. I forget the guy's name now, but I do remember he was military police.
Okay.
Not combat troops.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's fine for war, for peacetime, but in wartime, you are, what did they say? Yeah, this is your job, but you are also any duty required by the service or something like that. So anyway, I hope he doesn't have to don a gas mask. So, okay.
Yeah, well, you know, I'd like to say there's no circumstance in which a policeman would need one, but obviously that's not true. But fortunately, the military police that go out arresting drunken sailors and soldiers are usually not the same people that are attacking civilians.
Right. And that's been incredible craziness here in Las Vegas with our with our protests and with the police and then with the National Guard. I mean, it's shameful. But you had brought up, it's shameful, the reaction, I should say. If you don't know, I mean, our coven is very power to the people type thing. So you had brought up Loki and many developments recently with our understanding of Loki, and probably a softening of people's attitudes toward Loki, because in the 90s, there was a very, almost like Loki set the devil, almost like they were the boogeyman. And how has that changed?
Well, what I've seen was actually that wasn't like that in the 90s. That didn't actually start until a bit later, as far as the types of heathenry that I was experiencing myself. But I wasn't on the internet in the 90s, so I only saw the heathens that I personally practiced with, and in California and Nevada, and they were all pretty accepting people. But once I got on the internet, I was exposed to all kinds of people, including people who said they were heathens, but were really coming from a completely different mindset.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I saw people in my early internet experiences, everybody was pretty accepting of Loki.
Oh, good.
There was, when I was the manager of the MSN Also True group back in the day, when MSN groups were still there, I really didn't see people demonizing Loki. Not very much, anyway. I mean, you could mention him in the context of a trivia contest, and it would be, you know, not controversial.
Okay.
In fact, you could mention Loki and Odin and Thor in the context of a trivia contest and ask about their trans experiences, although that's not what we called it back then. Mm-hmm. And that was not controversial. That actually came a bit later when Also True started to grow and ran headfirst into white supremacists who came from a completely different system, but thought that they were in a similar system because everybody was using runes and talking about Odin, and they didn't even know, for the most part, that they were historical enemies of heathenry, although some of them knew very well and were there to try to recruit.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just been a growing menace ever since.
Right.
But I didn't encounter them until maybe about 15 years ago, after I'd already written the first version of my book. White supremacist and neo-Nazi presence on the internet has been growing and growing, and it's starting to become more, and it takes more and more time and effort to screen them out and keep them out of heathen groups.
Yeah.
And we have we've had to gatekeep against them basically the entire time that I've been on the admin or mod team of my forum. And when I basically inherited the management of that forum from the original owner, one of the main things I wanted to do was to make it formal how we were going to screen out Nazis.
Yeah.
Because we had been kind of doing it as an ad hoc basis. And I wanted to make an actual system for that, and which I did, but it's an ongoing process because they're always changing their symbols and coded messages and dog whistles that they use to escape the notice of the people that don't want them. and identify themselves to each other. So I have to keep after them and find out what they're doing lately in order to be able to identify them.
Well, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. Go ahead.
I wrote that system into the Trollstairs guide, which is what I call the guide for the moderators and admins of my forum. And there's a whole section in there about how to screen out white power and neo-Nazi people from the forum. And I've actually turned that section of the Trollslayer's Guide into an article, and it's about to be published in the next issue of Witches and Pagans magazine.
Awesome. And a few topics there. Witches and Pagans magazine is actually still a print magazine. Like, you can get that delivered to your door, correct? Like, I found one at Barnes & Noble a few months ago.
Yes, it is. It is a print magazine with a subscription base and is sold on newsstands.
And it's very pretty, very informative, and I like it a lot. And they're very rare, it seems, pagan magazines that are still like imprint hard copies that you can get to your door or at a newsstand, where there used to be Green Egg and Sage Woman and stuff like that. That's super cool. And then back to dealing with the Nazis. Weren't you on a hit list of sorts a while back? Like, I could have.
I was sort of. It was not really by an actual Nazi group, though. It was by a folkish group that was associated with actually another author this actually goes back to differing opinions about Loki within different parts of the heathen community, because I had reviewed a book about Loki that I thought was a terrible book, and the author happened to be a bigwig in the AFA and kind of sticked his followers on me and a few other people.
Yeah.
It was a big mess, but he was not an actual gang member. So it wasn't quite as dramatic as you may have heard.
I saw.
It wasn't like I had the Aryan Brotherhood after me or something.
Yeah.
Although I do regularly kick those guys out of my forum like all the time. They usually just leave.
It's unbelievable. But I think I saw a picture on Robert Shriver's Facebook page that he was on it too. The leader of the Oglave tradition, and it was a point of pride for him that you know, he posted that look at what these idiots have done. And I think there was a bunch of people pictured on it, and you were there too, and on the one hand a bit threatening, but then on the other hand a point of pride that clearly you're doing something right if Nazis don't approve of what you're doing.
Oh yeah, you know, there's a line from a song. I think it was originally G.K. Chesterton, but I'm not 100% sure. It goes, "My worth is known by my enemy's strength as much as strength of friends."
Oh, that's great. That's awesome.
Yeah. So, and that's a very hidden thing to think too, of course.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of go with that.
Well, and to get kind of away from the people, because people can so often be a problem, and get to the gods. You, as I read on your website or on a bio somewhere, are a dedicated priestess of Freya. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes. Way back when I was in college, when I made my priestess oath after 3 years of study, I actually thought that I was going to dedicate to Odin, and I went out in the woods and I was, I had like this entire thing, oath written, and it was all about Odin, and then Freya showed up.
That's awesome.
And,
How you pronounce it?
What's that?
While you were setting out, is it pronounced Utaseti?
Yes.
And so how then did you, Freya showed up, and then, so that changed your plans.
Yeah, she showed up in the form of a beam of light, and she completely remade me, and I dedicated myself to her as her priestess. And for the next 25 years, I was totally 100% content to be Freya's priestess, and I was no longer seeking Odin. And then suddenly this thing with this book came along, and suddenly Odin and Loki came into my life in a huge way. And and then, of course, where Loki goes, Sigyn also goes, his wife.
Yes.
And it turned out to be just the right time in my life for learning about Sigyn, because Sigyn is the goddess of caregiving, and I was starting to take care of my mom.
Uh-huh.
And in her declining years, and Freya gave me to Sigyn. So then I was Sigyn's priestess, and then my mom died in February, and shortly after that, Sigyn freed me. So now I'm really nobody's priestess, just a general Ossetru priestess, but I'm a god spouse of Odin and Loki.
Well, and I'm sorry to hear about your mom. Was that just this year?
That was this year, yeah.
Wow, so very recent.
Well, yeah, thanks. It was.
And it just
thank
goes
you.
To a testament of your honor taking care of your mom for so long.
Thank you.
So then tell us about...
It was...
Go ahead.
What was that?
Well, go ahead.
It was actually kind of hard to deal with the whole stay home for the pandemic thing, because I wasn't used to being alone.
Sure.
Anymore. I had I'd been used to having my mom here for years, and having only a few brief snatches of alone time here and there, and then suddenly I was alone.
Right.
So that was kind of hard to deal with for a while.
No, I can imagine. And my condolences. That really is a huge loss.
Thank you.
A lot of people talk about honoring ancestors. A lot of people talk about honoring elders. But, of course, you did it. You showed us by example.
Thanks.
So, the marriage with Odin and Loki?
Yes.
How did that come?
And Honir. And Honir also, yes. Well, I've actually blogged about that extensively on my blog, Gnosis Diary on Pagan Square, but here's the short version. While I was writing this book, there came a time when I realized that it wasn't just characters talking in my head, but the actual gods.
Mm-hmm.
And I panicked. I thought, wait, am I crazy? And then pretty soon it was like, no, I'm not. These are the gods. And then I panicked again, because throughout my life, when I'm done writing, the characters go silent. And I was suddenly afraid that when I was finished with my healing journey and writing this book, that they were going to stop talking.
Uh-huh.
And so one night while I was in that hypnagogic state between waking and sleeping, Loki came to me and he gave me a spiritual wedding ring. And then he said, "Here, shut up and write your book."
Wow.
Yeah, that's very Loki. He'll do something really a grand, extravagant gesture and then kick you in the butt if that's what you need.
And this talker, it sounds like.
And then 2 months later, Odin came along and added himself and Honir. With another two rings.
Wow.
So then there were three. And since that time, I've come to see Odin, Honir, and Loki, or Odin, Honir, and Lothar, which is another name for Loki, as a trinity.
Yes.
And they kind of flow into each other.
Are you able to contact them when you want to contact them? Do they contact you? How does that affect?
It's both. It's both. And it gets to a point where it doesn't even really take a huge amount of effort to contact them. If you're in this particular type of relationship with a god, which is kind of the point of it. The point of it is to be a temple keeper and to be able to ask for things and get answers and find out what they really want and what their vision is for you and for humanity and you know, to serve them.
That's beautiful. And it sounds like a fulfillment of practices that you've been doing for so long. I mean, it sounds like the sort of gnosis and experience and ongoing relationships that people are often looking for, people in all different religions and practices, but that's that kind of relationship with divinity that people are looking for.
Yes, a lot of people are looking for that, and there was a time in my life when I was looking for that kind of thing too, but when I was looking for it is when I wasn't ready for it.
Wow.
I wasn't ready for it until I stopped looking.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it also sounds like you did a lot of the work. I mean, you did the practices.
Well, yes.
You actually were true, whereas a lot of people kind of come and go in all, you know, practices, but you were true to the gods, long-term perseverance, and so, you know, did the work, basically.
Yes.
Do you?
And it was in the process of letting them help me and remake my mind and my life and everything through the medium of writing that book that I came to this, and it was because I let them lead.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't about me seeking, it was them leading.
Yes. Well, and let's talk about your book before I keep you here all day. Let's definitely talk about your book. I have the old version, and it is definitely it's called Asatru for Beginners, and that's what the new edition is going to be called as well, yes?
The new edition is called Asatru, A Beginner's Guide to the Heathen Path.
Ah, okay. And this is published by Wiser, so it should be well distributed and available on Barnes & Noble and Amazon and everywhere else. And it definitely is... It's clear, it's concise, it's to the point, it's very real. It's, you're not blowing smoke up people's asses. Where you draw the distinction between reconstructionist and modern, you also cite or at least talk about folk ways that are from the past. You do very clearly offer practices for people who are beginners. You offer practical advice, the frequently answered questions type approach makes it very accessible and understandable. And what kind of updates and edits, additions, have you made to this this version, this edition?
Well, I've already talked about a couple of them, you know, new research and the rise of modernism. New research included a lot of new information and details about the gods that I ran across while I was writing Some Say Fire, the novel, because I went through the entire corpus of heathen literature, and sometimes I picked out a few things that had been in the lore all along that just had never noticed. Like I realized how much the gods' family relationships matter. So in the first version of my book, I might have had like counterpart information, mm-hmm. Freyr and Freya are counterparts to each other, but I didn't really have a lot of information about the other members of their family trees. And I've put that in the new version of the book because I've discovered how much that makes a difference. And I've also discovered just a lot more information about it with the new research that's come out.
And also in the original
version of the book that was originally sold as an ebook when I first wrote it in 2001, it had a section in the back of recommended websites and stuff, and it was all full of MSN groups. And then when I did the print edition in 2010, that was only changed a tiny, tiny little bit from the ebook edition. But one of the changes was I replaced all the MSN groups with Yahoo groups. Uh-huh. And now in this edition, I'm like, okay, I have learned nothing's permanent. I'm not going to include any of that. And I'm not going to include any organizations for people to contact either, because I've learned that I can't guarantee any organization is still going to be an okay organization to be involved with 50 years from now over the life of a print book, except the one I control myself, which is the Awesome True Facebook forum. So that's the only one I'm recommending.
Good. I totally get it. People are fallible, people change, groups change, and when groups change leadership, sometimes they change, and there's some, as we talked about, Nazis, fascists, folkish, there's groups out there that they don't need your help, or they don't need our help.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I was going to ask real quick, I have a whole bunch of things written down because your writings often bring up a bunch of questions as well as informing. So as a priestess for Freya, which you were for so long, did she tell mm-hmm. you her name? Because of course Freya means lady.
No.
Did she tell you her name?
No.
Is that something you can share with us?
She never told me her name. In fact, that's One of the things that happened in Some Say Fire was that there was a scene in which the characters Freya and Sigyn were talking just before Ragnarok happened in the book, and I was aware that this was actually Freya talking, and she was about to tell Sigyn her real name, and I was excited. I was like, I'm going to learn her name. I'm going to learn her name. And then and then they were interrupted by someone else coming into the room. And I was like, I never learned her real name.
Oh, that's amazing. When we talk about runes, Sovilo rune, the rune of the S, the rune of the sun, mm-hmm. does it have a counterpart in the moon? There are so many natural events in the runes and the sun, but there's like the sun, but there's no super obvious rune for the moon. Do you?
That is true. That's a great observation.
Okay. Do you have any things along those, you know, or guesses or?
There really isn't a moon rune precisely. There are some runic powers that are more aligned with the light or lunar energy, but nothing specific to the moon the way Solilo is specific to the sun. Even though the sun and moon, Suna and Mani, are brother and sister in the lore, and they're both important god and goddess.
Right.
But the runes are, at least the Elder Futhark runes, are from a time in history when people were involved with basic survival to a greater extent than they were in the Viking Age or even in the age of the Germania and the Roman Empire.
Uh-huh.
If you look at what their runes stand for, there's runes for fire, there's runes for cow, there are runes for agricultural harvest. There are runes for things that are about just the most basic instruments of survival, and the sun was a basic instrument of survival.
Right, absolutely.
And the moon really wasn't in the far north, not to the extent the sun was. I mean, later on, people understood that the moon controlled the tides, and there was a huge amount of magic related to seafaring in the Viking Age. But that was much later. That was a much later part of history.
Mm-hmm.
And in the far north, in the time when the Elder Futhark runes were first starting to be used, it was cold. It was really, really cold. The runes go back to a time in history in which there were probably still woolly mammoths.
Right.
And yeah. And the sun was a basic instrument of survival in a way that the moon was just not to the ancient people.
Mm-hmm.
That created them.
So, speaking of when, runes and woolly mammoths and things, what are your thoughts on the creation or evolution borrowing from other written writing systems when it comes to the runes?
Well, the runes clearly were influenced by other people's writing systems. But there are also pictographs that go back to really ancient times that influence the Elder Futhark. And one of those is a sun sign, and it goes back to really, really ancient times. And you can see how that influenced the Raido symbol. And you can also see how other alphabets like the Greek and the Etruscan alphabets influenced the shapes of the Elder Futhark, but they're also definitely influenced by the pictographic symbols that go way, way back in history, back to the Stone Age goddesses and their little wavy lines.
Right, because a lot of those symbols do not look exactly like our Elder Futhark row now. Even the Savilo rune in a lot of things that I've seen don't look like an S necessarily. More like a...
Right. Right. Yeah, a lot of them, a lot of the shapes of the Elder Futhark really sent of the crosshatch designs on the Stone Age goddess figures.
Mm-hmm.
That were from the same part of the world. And you see the Elder Futhark develop as an alphabet in relation to and by the influence of other alphabets that came earlier, but you also see them develop from the pictographic symbols.
Yeah. Well, I think we've been talking quite a while. I could keep you here all day, but I think maybe right now I'll just probably ask you the most important question. So when you are toasting the gods, what is your preferred beverage? Mead? Is it ale? Is it wine? Is it something else?
Oh, boy, that's a great question. You know, I really like mead, but I also like to make my own things. So I have my Northern Lights Goddesses brew that I make every year, and that's a really super small batch, so I can't use it like all year. I usually only make like two bottles, one to keep for myself and one to bring to the Yule ritual, which every year I go to the Yule ritual put on by this other heathen group that's kind of a heathen / Ren Faire group that's got both heathens and non-heathens in it, but they all do the heathen Yule ritual. And I bring one of those bottles every year, and we toast with that. And that's probably my favorite because I grew it, because it came out of the wheat from my garden.
Oh, that's awesome.
But
that's fantastic.
But of course, I can't just have one bottle per year. I have to have many, many bottles. So mead is a good general purpose one, but I have other things that I offer to specific gods and goddesses, and it's not always alcohol either. For example, this weekend is Lindenfest, which is sacred to Frigga, and I'm planning to brew some linden tea later and toast Frigga with some linden tea.
Oh, that sounds awesome.
Yeah, well, it will be.
Thank you very much for talking with me and spending so much time with me this morning. Real quick, maybe you could tell us your book again, where it's available, and any other ways people might want to see what you write or see where you are, contact you, that sort of thing.
Yeah, the book is called Asatru, A Beginner's Guide to the Heathen Path. And it's going to be available starting August the 1st in bookstores and online. And if you would like to look up links to it, you can find the links to Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and IndieBound, which is where you can order it from independent bookstores, on my author website, which is erinlaleauthor.com.
And
my name is spelled E-R-I-N-L-A-L-E.
Perfect. Well, thank you very much, and it was
thank
great
you.
Talking to you.
You too. It was a pleasure to be on.
Awesome. Have a great day, and we look forward to the release of the book. Thank you, my lady.
Thank you.